good afternoon. Harry Brown here, and this is the Money Hour on the Genesis Network. I'll be here until the top of the next hour, and we'll be talking about the economy, investments, other financial issues and questions, and all around anything having to do with money, the production of it, the consumption of it, the distribution of it, the tearing up of it, the burying of it in the backyard, whatever. And you're invited to join the conversation. In fact, today I kind of welcome questions at 1-800-259-9231. I think we ought to make this a day of fielding questions from listeners on various aspects of investing, saving, and the like, because I know there are a lot of questions. In these broadcasts so far, and this is the fourth of them, in the broadcast so far, I've made it clear that I think that for the money that you cannot afford to lose, it is best to have a balanced portfolio. And if you have $4,000 or more in savings, it's possible to set up such a portfolio on your own, according to the recommendations I gave a couple of weeks ago. If you don't have that much money, there is a mutual fund called the Permanent Portfolio Fund, which allows you to buy shares in a mutual fund, which operates with a balanced portfolio and keeps a fixed percentage in various kinds of investments permanently without tinkering with it, which is the same concept as what I have suggested for an individual to set up on his own. And the point being that it's possible for just about anybody to do this, and it's possible to make sure that whatever happens, prosperity, inflation, deflation, recession, whatever, your savings, the money that's precious to you, the money you're counting on for your children's education, for your retirement, and so on, that this money can be safe. And this has been proven over the last few decades. Such a portfolio gained 9% a year over the last 34 years, and it has had only four losing years, the worst of which was 6% in 1981. Contrast that with the roller coaster ride that the stock market has had, or gold has had, or any other single investment. A package of investments is not only probably going to produce a better return, and probably, not probably, but undoubtedly, be safer, but it is also more stable. It grows year after year after year, rather than swinging upward and then coming back and then swinging up and so forth and so on. But I realize that there are going to be people that aren't going to take this advice, that are going to continue to try to beat the market with money that's precious to them. And in addition, I've said that if you have a permanent portfolio, if you have this diversified and balanced portfolio, you might also want to have a second portfolio that's funded with money that you can afford to lose. That if you lost all of that second portfolio, it would not change your plans for retirement or make you have to yank your children out of college or whatever it might be. And with that second portfolio, with what I call the variable portfolio, you may want to just speculate then and try to beat the market. And if you do, then good luck to you. And so today, to open the show, I thought that what we might talk about is how the economy affects these things and what is a realistic view of the economy. Now, let me take as an example the oil price, which has been flying upward lately, as reflected in the higher and higher gas prices at your local gas station. And you see this happening, and people are talking about it, and everybody who is really smart and really educated and really intellectual is saying, what is our national energy policy? Why don't we have a national energy policy? Or couldn't we have a better national energy policy? And shouldn't we be working on the development of alternative energies, renewable energies, which means that you have something that continually renews itself, like wind power, which, because the wind will never stop, keeps renewing, keeps creating more energy, whereas we're running out of oil, we're running out of fossil fuels, and so on. So why don't we have a national energy policy? Well, George Bush might say that we do. And he could ask Dick Cheney what it is, and Dick Cheney could ask his friends at Halliburton what it is, and sooner or later we would get an answer. But in the meantime, John Kerry will put forth at some point along the way a national energy policy he thinks is much better, and it's bound to include renewable energies in there. It's wind power, hydroelectric power, probably just about anything except for fossil fuels, meaning oil, and without including nuclear energy. Nuclear energy, I believe, is probably the wave of the future, but the future may be a long time away before politics lets nuclear energy take hold and produce the kind of low-cost energy we need. But that's another story. Now, my point in all of this is that whenever politicians talk about such things as a national energy policy, what they are really saying is, I know the future. I know better than anybody else what we should do, and I have at my disposal all the knowledge in the world to work with. And therefore, I can say unquestioningly that this is what must be done, and if the government will do it, then the government will force everybody to abide by what I have decided is the best thing to do. Now, how realistic is that? How realistic is it to think that a bunch of guys in Washington, D.C. have got this all figured out when they don't even read the bills that they vote for, when they don't read the research reports that are presented to them by their aides who get them from lobbyists in Washington? How realistic is it to think that all the wisdom and knowledge is there in Washington, D.C.? Obviously, it's not realistic at all. But is there any alternative to letting these people decide what the national energy policy should be? Of course there's an alternative. The alternative is to do nothing and simply let events take their course. What will happen if we simply let events take their course? Well, we will then find out if the world is running out of fossil fuel. We don't really know that it is. We only know that people say that it is. We have no idea where there may be reserves of oil in this world that haven't been touched yet. They were too expensive to touch when the price of oil was $25 a barrel, but now at $45 a barrel, there may be possibilities to go and dig up oil in parts of the world that will reveal huge, huge reserves of oil that not only might keep the price from going higher than $45 a barrel, but might send the price back down to $30 or $25 or $20 or even as low as $10 a barrel, where it was not too very, very long ago. We don't know, and we will never find out, if the government is making these decisions and deciding what will be done. Well, let's pursue this a little bit further because it has very definite investment implications, and I want to get to those implications and show you how this kind of analysis applies to investment decisions. We'll come back in just a couple of minutes after we hear these words. This is Harry Brown. Welcome back. This is Harry Brown, and this is the Money Hour on Sunday afternoon, August 29th, 2004. And if you have a question, a comment, anything, just give me a call at 1-800-259-9231. That's 1-800-259-9231. And if you're too shy, then just email me. The address is question@harrybrown.org. question@harrybrown.org, and Brown has an E on the end of it. Now, we were talking about the oil price, and it has risen to $45 an ounce, and everybody is tisking and saying we've got to get away from fossil fuel and so forth. And, of course, the government has been, through various coercive methods, trying to get Americans off of fossil fuel. If you're producing a car, you have to be able to produce a car that gets so many miles per gallon, or else they won't let you produce the cars. And they keep raising that over the years and so on as a way of trying to dampen consumption of oil in this country. But the point is that they're working with very, very limited knowledge in Washington. And if they simply released all the controls and quit meddling with this, then what would happen is that the price of oil would find its own level. And how would it find its own level? It would find its own level based not on the knowledge and wisdom that's available in Washington, D.C., but on the knowledge and wisdom that's available in the whole world. Everybody who knows anything about oil would then bring that to bear on the oil price. And the oil price would find its own level. And that level might be $70 a barrel. It might be $20 a barrel. If the government were not trying to determine what it ought to be and trying to force it to be what it ought to be, then it will simply find its own level. And if we do need to have wind-generated or hydroelectric-generated or nuclear-generated energy in this country, that will happen on its own without anybody forcing it. There shouldn't be any subsidies to these various industries because no subsidies are necessary in the free market. If the price of oil gets too high, then people will look for alternatives because those alternatives will allow them to sell a product, low-cost electric power, at a price cheaper than the oil companies can sell that product. So the point being that these things work themselves out on their own, and no national policy is necessary. Whether we're talking about energy or food or anything else, these things always work themselves out. Now, what's the investment implication of all of this? Well, the investment implication is that any time the government imposes a policy, the market will be distorted. What will happen is that there will develop a shortage of oil because the government is doing everything it can to suppress it from getting into the market. There will be an overabundance of the wrong kind of energy. There will be market dislocations. And speculation in the marketplace relies on market dislocations. It relies on you being able to discern that the price of something, whether it is oil or a particular stock or gold or some other commodity, that the price of something is not where you think it ought to be. That you think that the supply and demand for this particular item, or the near-term future supply and demand of this item determine that it should be at a certain level where the price is not now, and that you can make some money by betting that the price is going to go to that level that you have discerned is the more likely level that will sustain the market and keep supply and demand in harmony. Now, that's all that speculating is. A speculator is someone who buys something when nobody else wants it and sells it when everybody else wants it. I should amend that to say a successful speculator is someone who buys something when no one else wants it and sells it when everyone else wants it. Or vice versa. He sells it short when everyone wants it and buys it back when nobody wants it. And that's the point and the purpose of all this. And any time the government interferes in the market, it creates a dislocation. whereby people are paying too little for something that they're eventually going to have to pay a great deal more for, or they're paying too much for something that eventually is bound to come down in price, and so some money might be made by selling it short or selling it at a future price that is determined today and is going to be way higher than what you can actually buy the price for in the future and fulfill your contract to sell it. So a great deal of investing and speculating over the last half century, really, has been in the area of trying to discern where the government has distorted the market and where there is some way of profiting from it. A good example of this, probably a very extreme example, occurred in the 1960s and 70s. And in that particular era, a lot of people realized that the government had created gigantic dislocations. Dislocations, in fact, that were so great that we probably will never see anything like it again. But just because they were so extreme and they were so gigantic, it creates an easy opportunity to see this principle at work. And then it might be easier to apply it in more normal situations that occur in the future. So after we take this next break, I will give a little description of what happened in the 60s and 70s to create giant dislocations on which a lot of people made their fortunes. Unfortunately, a lot of people expect it to happen again in such a big way, and they probably are going to be disappointed. But in the meantime, be thinking about your question, and why don't you give me a call, and just as soon as I give that report, I will be glad to answer any questions over the phone. The number is 1-800-259-9231. That's 1-800-259-9231. Or email me question@harrybrown.org. And Brown has an E on it. This is Harry Brown. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Welcome back. Thanks for staying with me during the break. This is Harry Brown, and the phone number is 1-800-259-9231. And I said, before we went to the break, I said that I'd give you an example, such an extreme example, that it highlights a principle at work, but it's not likely to be repeated, and I don't believe it will be repeated. It's, at least it's not very likely. The price of gold was set by the government in, way, way back in the 19th century at $20.67 an ounce, and in 1933, the government raised it to $35 an ounce in order to stimulate activity in the economy according to a very, very shaky economic philosophy that was perpetrated on Franklin Roosevelt by Henry Wallace, who was his Secretary of Agriculture. And it, of course, did nothing to stimulate the economy. But from then on, the price of gold was $35, and American citizens were prevented from owning gold except overseas. And then during the Eisenhower era, Americans were prevented even from owning gold overseas. I shouldn't say prevented, I should say prohibited. And then, as things developed, the money supply increased rapidly, inflation was rearing its head, the world was changing rapidly, but the price of gold was still at $35 an ounce. And in the late 60s, a few people realized that $35 was very unrealistic. And the price was being kept there in the world market by the U.S. government and a few other governments dumping their gold reserves on the London gold market, so that whenever anybody was willing to pay $36 an ounce for gold, the governments would move in and dump gold to keep the price back at $35 an ounce. Well, of course, the gold supply that the governments had to do this dumping was finite. Now, at the same time, we had a somewhat similar situation in silver. The monetary price of silver set by the government was $1.29 an ounce. And for years, the price, actual price of silver in the market had been considerably less than that. But the government began, when the price got up to 91 cents, the U.S. government began dumping silver on the market to hold it at 91 cents an ounce. And the silver that they dumped, they had because way back in the 19th century, they had tried to prop up the price of silver by buying silver from mines. To keep the price upward and to keep it from falling, the U.S. government would generate an artificial demand by buying silver. Well, in the process, they accumulated 2 billion ounces of silver. And so in the early 60s, when silver threatened to go above 91 cents an ounce, the government decided it better start dumping the silver on the market, and it did so. And then when they had trouble holding it at 91 cents, they finally allowed it to go up to $1.29 to the monetary price. And that's where it was in the late 60s. Well, in the meantime, all sorts of uses for silver had emerged in the marketplace. And as a result, the demand for silver was far, far greater than it had been 20 or 30 years before. And again, a few people who paid attention to this realized that the government could not hold out forever, keeping the price at $1.29 an ounce, that sooner or later they would have to throw in the towel. And so these people started buying silver and storing it, waiting for the price to finally break out of the $1.29 limit. And finally, you had a similar situation in the currency market, in that the major countries of the world all agreed to keep their currency prices fixed. That means that the price of a Swiss franc in U.S. dollars was just 23 cents a franc. And if the price threatened to go above 23 cents, then the Swiss government was obligated to buy U.S. dollars, to just print more Swiss francs and buy U.S. dollars to hold the price of the franc down to 23 cents an ounce. And it did so. And the Germans did the same thing to hold the price of the mark down, and the British did the same thing to hold the price of the pound down. And there were other currencies that were weaker than the U.S. dollar, so the U.S. government was printing dollars to buy these weaker currencies to keep their prices from falling and to keep the dollar from rising against those currencies. So here we had three different items, gold, silver, and foreign currencies, that had all been price controlled in effect for so many years that their prices were now very, very unrealistically low. And some people decided in the late 60s and the early 70s to bet against the U.S. government, to bet against the possibility that the U.S. government could hold these prices at these levels. And sooner or later, the dam broke. In early 1973, the Swiss government said, "We're printing too many francs, we're creating inflation in Switzerland, we can't afford to print these francs and flood the markets with more Swiss francs just to keep the U.S. dollar from falling." So the Swiss government dropped out of what was called the fixed exchange rate system, and the price of the franc started rising. Then the price of silver started rising. Then the price of gold in the free market started rising. It actually started rising first in 1973. It rose during that year to $100 an ounce, and then fell back a little ways, and then it started upward again. Well, to make a long story short, by the end of the decade, the Swiss franc, which had been 23 cents, was now around 70 cents. Silver, which had been $1.29, eventually hit $48 an ounce in 1980 and then quickly fell backward because it had far overshot the mark and settled in the range of around $5 an ounce. Gold, which had started at $35 an ounce, went up to $800, then fell back down to $300 and remained in the $300 to $400 range throughout the 1980s and now is around $400 an ounce. And silver, I'm sorry, I haven't checked it recently, but silver is a little higher than $5 an ounce, I believe, but I'll let you know after the next break. And the Swiss franc has remained pretty much where it was. It's now at about 80 cents an ounce, so it's maybe 15% higher than what it reached at the end of the 1970s. Well, this was a tremendous once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for some people who were paying attention to be able to capitalize on distortions in prices that had been created by government policies, similar to a national energy policy. It doesn't matter what the government tries to do, it is working with limited knowledge. And there's also another reason that these government policies never turn out the way that they're supposed to, and in the process create speculative opportunities, and we'll discuss that when we come back. Welcome back. This is Harry Brown. Phone number is 1-800-259-9231, and I said I would give you a second reason that energy policies, gold policies, any kind of national policy set by Congress is not going to work, and I will give it to you just as soon as we have talked with Dave in California, or David. Good afternoon, David.
Yeah, hi. How are you, Harry? I was listening with interest to this. I'm not sure if you've ever read the. There was a book that came out every election year for the last. Well, I believe he died. T.H. White, was it? And he came out with the series Making of the President.
Oh yes, Theodore White.
Right, great series. And if you find the book Making of the President, 1972. And look in the index under gold, you'll find a good description of what you were just talking about the last segment. And it's kind of interesting. In some ways, he agrees with you, and in some ways, his rationale behind it is a little different. But it gives you a lot of insight about that. And he makes it pretty plain that that Fort Knox was essentially empty by the time. And the 1972, well, by the time Watergate came along. And it's kind of interesting in a number of reasons, for a number of reasons, because if you think about Fort Knox being empty and Watergate as a scandal, you would think that Fort Knox being empty would be a much bigger scandal.
Sure.
And so it's almost as if Watergate was a cover-up for the emptying of Fort Knox.
Well, I don't know what he meant by Fort Knox being empty, whether he just meant it had been depleted a lot or whether he really believed there was no gold there. Do you know what he meant by it?
Well, I think he was saying that that by privatizing the gold markets, or by opening up the gold market, he was essentially Nixon. Nixon was essentially allowing gold speculators to manage or run America, and by allowing them to run America or run the world, it was no longer a democracy, and that as an enormous problem. Helped create the current situation that we're in. I mean, it was very bad, of course, back then when corporations were telling the politicians what to do. But when currency speculators were able to do that and the people were no longer able to help decide through representation where to take the country, that was an enormous danger. And
whom would you want to trust? And I wonder whom Theodore White would want to trust. People in Congress to make their decisions, these representatives of the people who suffer no consequences when they make the wrong decision, because 99 out of 100 people who vote have no idea what their congressmen have voted for, so no congressman ever suffers for making a wrong decision, or speculators who, every time they're wrong, take an enormous hit in their own personal resources and their own lifestyle and their own ability to do things in the future, and thus have to be right or suffer the consequences for being wrong. If I had to put my trust in somebody, it would be in the speculator and not in the congressman. But I know Theodore White wouldn't see it that way.
Well, yeah, I also would disagree with you completely in that the... As you know, and I think you mentioned this just in your last little section there, that the speculators really don't care about the future. They just care about the short-term gain.
Well,
so, for example, if you looked at currency speculators, before the International Monetary Fund was created, currency speculators were essentially the reasons why there were wars in the world. You would have some currency speculator come up with a PR campaign telling us that we should hate some nation or praise some nation, and their currency would rise against another currency. Then those speculators would be secretly buying up or selling that nation's currencies. And then along would come another PR campaign telling us to, instead of hating, then we should praise another nation. And so they would essentially puff up and break down nations' currencies on a regular basis and essentially buy low and sell high. And it's what the danger is in that is that the reputations of all of those people on the other side of the imaginary line that is France or England or Turkey or Bombay or wherever, those people, their reputations would be ruined, and they would have to pay higher interest rates. They would have to work harder and get less hourly pay, or their currency would have a less valuation.
Well, why doesn't that happen today?
Well, it does, actually.
Well, actually, I don't think you can cite an example where speculators are causing wars today, and yet today they have the communications facilities to do so. In the old days that you're talking about, they didn't have television, they didn't have the internet, they didn't even have radio as a way by which they could generate such a public relations campaign. Those wars were generated in the seats of power, not in the trading rooms. But we'll just have to disagree about that, David. But thank you very much for calling Theodore White's comments to all of us and to all of our attentions. And we will be back, folks, in just a couple of minutes. Well, this is our last segment, so let me begin by thanking John Harmon for taking care of everything in the booth in Minnesota so that we stayed on the air, didn't have any problems, and I appreciate it. But most of all, I want to thank you for listening to the show, and I hope you'll tune in again next week. But we're not done yet today. A little housekeeping here. I said earlier that I'd check and bring you up to date on what the prices are on those investments that went up so dramatically in the 1970s. Gold bullion today, well, let's say on Friday, was at $403. It had been at $35 for many years, from 1933 until in the late 60s. It inched its way upward a little, but it was in the early 1970s that it finally shot upward and hit $800 in 1980 and then fell back to $300 and now has inched its way back up to $400. Silver is at $6.59. It had been at $1.29 for many years, then shot up to $48, came back down to $5, and now has inched its way up to $6.59. And the Swiss franc, which shot up from 23 cents to 70 cents in the 1970s, has managed to get up to about 78 cents today. Now, a lot of people are expecting that once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that occurred in the 1970s to happen again. Well, if inflation comes back, gold could very definitely shoot upward, and it would not be impossible for it to go to $1,000 or even $2,000 an ounce. But it's not going to happen until inflation is noticeable in the United States. That means the consumer price index rising at 5, 6, 7, 10% noticeable figures. And next week, perhaps I should make a note to talk about what it is that makes the gold price go up. I don't think a lot of people understand the firm tie that exists between inflation and gold. They think that crises can make gold go up, and they think other things might make gold go up. One other item, Dave, a different Dave from the one we just talked to, Dave in Phoenix, wonders if that 9% yearly gain in the permanent portfolio that I mentioned earlier was before or after inflation is counted. It is before inflation is calculated. Generally speaking, you should expect that the rate of return on a permanent portfolio should be 4.5% or 5% after inflation. And I also promised you that I'd give you one more reason that government policies do not produce the results intended. The first reason was that there's such limited knowledge in Washington, D.C., whereas when you let the market take care of it, you have all the knowledge of the world. The other reason is that government managers aren't motivated to pay attention to long-term consequences as private managers are. Company executives have to think about the future. Congressmen don't. Thanks so much for tuning in today. We will be back next week, and I look forward to talking with you then. Please do something nice for yourself this week and come back and meet me again here next week. This is Harry Brown. Bye-bye.